Miami's new mayor, Francis Suarez, joins us today to discuss his goals for the city. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Francis Suarez easily won the mayoral election earlier this month, and he's going to take the seat once held by his father. We'll talk to him about some of his bigger plans, especially the plan to try and give his position greater power. Patricia Mazzei has been reporting on politics, natural disasters, and the wonderful oddities of life in South Florida for 10 years. She's leaving the Miami Herald, but not Miami. She's going to be covering life in South Florida for the New York Times. We spoke to her about life in the trenches of the newspaper industry. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, Francis Suarez easily won the mayoral race for Miami earlier this month. He was sworn into office last week, and now he has the daunting task, as any politician, of following through on promises. Miami's a growing city, which means a lot of growing pains and a lot of challenges. What are his biggest goals? We're joined now by Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, and if you have a question for the mayor, you can tweet us. Our handle is at WLRN Sundial, or you can give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Let's talk about those goals. Mayor Suarez, welcome to the program.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
First of all, congratulations.
Thank you. It's been a week and an hour since I was officially sworn in.
And in that week and an hour, what are some of the things that you've already been doing?
Well, I've been working on some of the big issues. I had a commission meeting the day after and was renominated to the Transportation Planning Organization, which is a board that I vice chair, which deals with one of the major issues in our city and in our county, which is traffic, and got a micro unit piece of legislation passed as well, which addresses one of the other major issues in our community, which is affordable housing. So I'm working very vigorously on those two issues, as well as resiliency, which is probably the third big issue that we as a community have to deal with, because it's not just an existential threat to the city, but it's also a threat to, you know, sort of a counter branding, if you will, from people that are outside of the city who say, why invest in Miami? Why go live in Miami? They're going to be underwater in the next 10, 15 years. So, you know, as mayor, we not only have to deal with this issue, you know, from an engineering perspective and a quality of life perspective, but certainly we also have to deal with it from a branding perspective.
All right. And we're going to try to hit on all of these different points if we can today. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. If you have a question for Mayor Francis Suarez, or if you'd like, you can also tweet that at WLRN Sundial. Let's start with the big news that happened this week. The Department of Homeland Security announced temporary protective status ending for tens of thousands of Haitians. Yeah. That's going to have a massive impact here in our area, in South Florida. What exactly can you do, though, to help the Haitian community? This is a federal issue.
Well, you know, as mayor, you have a voice. You have a voice that people listen to. And I tweeted out pretty immediately that, you know, I'm very saddened by that decision, because, you know, what makes our city great is its inclusion and diversity. And certainly the Haitian people are part of the soul of the city of Miami. So for me, it's very worrisome when, you know, a people that have come here, that have struggled to get here, and who are great law-abiding, hardworking, good people, don't have the opportunity, or may not have the opportunity in the future, of realizing the American dream that we all strive for, and a dream to live in liberty, and a dream to live in happiness and in peace. And so, you know, certainly continuing to communicate that message, I think, is important, because to the extent that we as local leaders are listened to, we want to make sure our voice is being heard.
Do you worry, though, at some point, because they have until the summer of,
sure,
you know, 2019, that at some point we may have to just say, okay, now we have to just help them prepare for leave.
You know, I'm hoping that the federal government changes their perspective. I'm hoping that they continue to extend or make permanent this status, this legal status. But certainly, you know, to the extent that we need to be helpful in any sort of transitionary phase. You know, the city of Miami, which is an immigrant city, it's a city of immigrants, stands really ready, willing, and able to help in any way we can.
And, of course, Congressman Carlos Cabello is one of those leaders right now in D.C. who is trying to work a bill to create a path for permanent residency for these folks. That's a story, of course, that we'll keep track of. The other thing in the news we have to mention, of course, is that yesterday, former mayor and commissioner Joe Carollo beat out Alfonso Leon for the Miami District 3 commissioner seat. He replaced your father's mayor. Look, there's a history there with the family. So, I mean, what do you think about going into, now into your position and now he's moving into that position and that history is there? I mean, you got to work together, right?
Yeah,
but,
of course.
But there's tension. There's history.
Look, I have my own political identity. I am my own person. I've been very blessed to serve as a commissioner in the city already for 8 years. I've had a wonderful working relationship with former Mayor Carollo, now commissioner-elect. I've always been accessible to him, transparent. And, look, I think we are all who are in public service and who have other family members who are in public service, have our own distinct identities. We have our own distinct friends and colleagues and we have our own distinct sort of alliances, et cetera. And I think my reputation is one, and I think it's evidenced in the election. I'm a bridge builder. I'm someone who tries to really pierce through a lot of that political stuff and just get to the core of things. And I do it just by trying to treat people kindly, trying to treat people transparently and working with people. I mean, I've been able to work, for example, the former mayor's brother, who was my colleague on the commission. We had 8 wonderful years together. At the end of them, he didn't run against me. In fact, he endorsed me in my candidacy for mayor. So, look, I think there's ample precedent on my end in terms of my ability to work with the incoming commissioner. And that's what I'm going to do, because at the end of the day, it's not about me or him. It's really about the people that we serve. And if we are doing our job, which is to serve those people faithfully, then there really isn't any room for egos.
Again, I'm talking with Mayor Francis Suarez, Miami Mayor Francis Suarez. He has been in office now just a little over a week. And if you have a question for him, the number is 800-743-9576, or you can tweet us at WLRN Sundial. Before I get to any calls, though, let's talk about some of your bigger goals. We're going to try to hit up as many of these as we can. One of them is that I find interesting is you want to change your position, the actual power that the mayor has. What exactly, let's remind people, what exactly the mayor of Miami actually is, what he represents, and what exactly is it you want to do?
So something I've been trying to do since I was a commissioner. I've tried it a couple of times. I think the current system of government is dysfunctional. I think it creates a lack of accountability and instability. And I say that because, for example, in the 8 years that I was commissioner, we had 5 different city managers in 8 years. And so that means that we had a manager for less than on average 2 years, which is very difficult to set a culture for a government that has a $1 billion budget with 4,500 employees. You also have a situation where the mayor chooses the manager, but it's subject to ratification by the commission. The commission can then fire the manager by a supermajority. So can the mayor, but neither the mayor nor the commission can actually tell the manager what to do. So it's very confusing. The poor manager doesn't know who he works for, who she works for, in terms of, am I supposed to respond to the mayor? Am I supposed to respond to the commission? Am I supposed to respond to both? Sometimes they don't get along with each other. And the commissioners can't talk to each other. So it's just a very strange system of government. All the major cities in the U.S. have what they call a strong mayor system of government. And I call it a strong voter system of government, because at the end of the day, what you want is a system where the voters can clearly define who's accountable for what. And even in our current system, the mayor is not recallable. And so I think that should be part of the strong mayor form of government as well, where the people have the ultimate right to change their mayor if the person's not doing their job.
And while you were trying to do that as a commissioner, make that change, I mean, what kind of pushback did you get?
I got some pushback at the time from the commissioners themselves, because there is a perception that it could dilute their power. with the fact that they no longer have any sort of control over the city manager in terms of the selection or the dismissal. But I think it's something that is and some of them were just questions about the technical aspects of it. For me, I think potentially what I'll do is I'll do a petition drive, which allows the initiative to go directly on the ballot.
What do you think this commission is going to do, though, on this issue? I mean, and what are you going to have to do to convince them?
I'm not sure. The good thing is, number one, as mayor, I have the right to talk to them. Before, as a commissioner, I couldn't talk to them. So that made it challenging. And the second part is, in terms of changing the system of government, we have a petition format. So we can actually do it directly with the voters. In other words, go directly to the voters and ask the voters, just like I did when I ran for office. I'm the first mayor of Miami in its history to actually petition onto the ballot. I went out there and I got signatures from people to get on the ballot. And I find that to be a hyper-democratic system and a hyper-democratic way of instituting change and reform to make our system more accountable to the very people that we represent.
All right, again, the number is 800-743-9576. If you have a question for Miami's new mayor, Mayor Francis Suarez, we'd like to hear from you. You can also tweet us at WLRN Sundial. Let's go to the phones. I've got Neil in Miami. Neil, you've got a question for the mayor.
Yes, good afternoon, Mayor. Congratulations on your election.
Thank you, Neil.
I figured you'd be the perfect guy to ask about this topic because since you're also the mayor and on the Transportation Commission.
Yes, sir.
The Metro Rail system in Miami is a huge benefit to people who live along the Dixie Highway corridor and frankly Kendall and elsewhere.
Yep.
I've heard for a long time that we have replacement Metro Rail cars that have already been purchased.
Yep.
But they're not on the rails yet, and it seems like this system is becoming less and less reliable.
Right.
And so I wanted to know what the status is with those Metrorail cars, the replacement of the existing cars, and also whether or not there's a plan to expand the existing Metrorail system.
Thank you.
And I'll take my answer off the air. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Neil, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
So first of all, the Metrorail system is run by Miami-Dade County. I've heard similarly, and as a TPO member, I can certainly ask what is the status of those replacement cars being put on the rail line. I can tell you that the system is operating at a very near capacity or over capacity. And I can also say that there will be continued development along the corridor, which means that it will continue to intensify in terms of its capacity. So I think the county is going to have to continue to invest in the system as it currently is built. But I proposed an expansion of the system, which is called the SMART Plan, the Strategic Miami Area Rapid Transit Plan. And that was unanimously approved by the TPO, by the Transportation Planning Organization. And what that does is it creates 6 new transit lines that expand from the current system, which would much more comprehensively cover the county. I think the part of the problem and part of the reason why we have so low numbers in terms of our overall utility of the system. I think 97% of people are using their cars to get to and from work, and most of them are not carpooling, is because the system is just not large enough to cover enough of the county. So it's sort of inadequate. And so this plan, while not being the entire solution, would certainly much more comprehensively cover the county and hopefully decongest some of our streets.
When you look at Miami right now, and you talk about that, because that is one of the big issues that you've talked about in the campaign and after winning, is the issue with transportation and the issue with traffic. Look, Miami's continuing to grow, and of course we see all of these very large buildings that are popping up, which means more cars on the city. What, for you, as you look at it, is there a solution right now?
Well, we have a thriving trolley system. We have a free trolley system that is carrying 450,000 riders per month. And one of my initiatives is to expand that trolley system to cover the entire city. Right now, it covers about 2/3 of the city. So I think that's one possible solution. I think the other one is, technology is incredible in the way that it's disrupting the way we do business. And we see that with ride-sharing companies. We see that with automation and the possibility, the prospect of autonomous vehicles in the future. And that would change radically the way we do things. The third part is, that because of technology nowadays, people are less and less working in an office. They're more and more working from home. And that also could be a major disruptor. I mean, now you know, with phones, you can do, video conferencing. It's normal. And so it allows you to sort of close the gap, if you will, between people. And even though there's a large gap in proximity in terms of distance. So I think, you know, our society is changing very rapidly and very radically. And I think that could also impact traffic and in the county.
Now, I don't know if smart cars, isn't the smart cars. I don't know if these autonomous cars are going to be out before you leave office.
I don't know either.
But I'm just saying, you know, if there's one thing that you think is possible,
sure,
plausible, something that and talk about cost,
right,
that can happen in the next 4 to 8 years, what would that be?
So one is a deal that I helped fashion with the county mayor, which is Tri-Rail connecting to the All Aboard station in downtown. Right now, the Tri-Rail runs a little to the east, to the west, and that one, that line will now connect to the All Aboard station, so that will give Tri-County accessibility and connectability. The other one is just getting started on the smart plan. I mean, I think we have two corridors that we just prioritized as the TPO, which is the north and the south corridor, which would connect the entire county north to south. And though we have already the already existing right-of-ways there, we have the FEC coastal line that's there, and all we have to do is activate it. And we have the South Dade Busway, which is a corridor that's also already obtained in terms of right-of-way. So it's just a matter of activating those corridors. And certainly we put a funding mechanism in place to do the entire smart plan, but it requires state help. And so we'll be going to the state and continuing to ask them to help fund our plan.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576. If you have a question for the mayor, let's go to Jeff in Miami. Jeff, thanks for holding.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor.
Afternoon.
I'm going to hang up after I ask this question because I'm on the highway. But my question is this. I heard you mention that you're a supporter of keeping the Haitian community who would otherwise have been sent back once this temporary visa program is revoked federally. You're a supporter of keeping them in, and you're going to do whatever you can to see that that happens. I'm having trouble understanding why that's the right thing to do. And let me just say that, the political rhetoric of saying that they're integrated into the community and that they're contributing positively, et cetera, that's all well and good. Just like any other group of people, some of them are contributing positively, a few of them are contributing negatively, but that has nothing to do with it. The issue is, in my mind, unless you can explain how I'm thinking about this wrong, they were brought here on a temporary emergency visa. When the emergency is over, they're supposed to go back. And I just can't figure out why there's the talk of converting that temporary emergency visa into permanent citizenship or residence. So thank you very much for taking my question. I'm going to hang up now and listen to your answer. Have a great day.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
And I appreciate that. No, and look, everyone, I think, is entitled to their perspective and opinion on this issue as on any other issue. From my perspective, having been a product of an immigrant family where I think my father and my grandfather probably thought that their residency in the United States would be temporary as well, and it turned out to be permanent. I'm just someone who feels that, you have a population of people who want to be productive members of this amazing country that we have. And one of the great things about this country is, if you think about it, it's a country of immigrants, built by immigrants and created by immigrants. And so for me, people who want to yearn for the American dream, shouldn't be prevented from doing that.
We will mention also, by the way, that yesterday we did hear from a number of people in the Haitian community who had responded to the end of TPS. One Haitian woman did say, it's temporary. It was always temporary. We should have always have known that. And that's how it is. It's not permanent.
Yeah.
So that, as you said, many different perspectives.
Yeah.
This is, again, a story that we will be following very closely. But thank you, Jeff, for bringing up that perspective. Let's move over to affordable housing, another big issue. We just actually reported this the other day. Miami, one of the worst cities in the U.S. for renters.
Yep.
It's also really a tough place to buy a house right now. Values are very high, and that doesn't match with a lot of salaries. We have a lot of people here struggling just for housing. But look, a lot of people talk about how to approach this issue. You know, give me a realistic view of how exactly could you even begin to tackle it?
Well, I've done it as a commissioner for 8 years. I've created initiatives that have created about 1,600 units of affordable housing. About 1,000 of them were through entitlements. We reverse engineered the tax credit program, the state tax credit program, and we got 1,000 units in one lottery-based tax credit cycle. It was so successful that the state actually had to reverse engineer our reverse engineering and made it a system where the state would now divvy up the 9% credits through a zone type system so that not one area could get more than their fair share for the state. And the other thing that we did was we wisely invested our funds in one of our community redevelopment agencies and did about $60 million worth of affordable housing in the area of Overtown. And it's changed the complexion of Overtown. Oftentimes one of my dear friends, Commissioner Hardiman, will say that, the cycle of violence and poverty in our community is a cycle. It's not just one specific thing. And so, I think giving people dignity in their housing and helping them is something that would help with that. And we've seen our homicide rate drop precipitously in the last 3.5 years as a result of a variety of different, I think, actions that we've taken. We went from a high of 84 to now we're down to in the 50s. So, to answer your question, we have to be smart. We have to leverage our assets. We have community redevelopment agency funds. We just got $100 million from the general obligation bond for affordable housing. And we have a lot of county and city land that is underutilized that we can leverage in addition to those dollars to build units.
Let me look at it from this perspective. The pool of affordable housing is shrinking. As we see neighborhoods gentrifying, Little Haiti, Little Havana, Wynwood, Edgewater, the West Grove. Do you think gentrification is a problem here, and how do we mitigate the effects?
Of course it's a problem. I mean, I think, our blessing is in some ways our curse. I mean, we had a 1 acre parcel in downtown sell for $125 million, and it was dirt. So, certainly there's pressure because people want to be here, because people want to be here from all over the world, and because we have a very favorable tax environment. So as between us and other parts of the world and the country, we are definitely attracting a lot of investment. We've grown 37% in the last 3 years alone. So there's definitely a fear of gentrification, and particularly in some of our more classic neighborhoods. And so, we as a government have to do what we can. And I've talked about some of the things we've done, and I've talked about some of the things that we can do to prevent that from happening.
You mentioned the bond money, and yeah. This, of course, was the Miami Forever bond voters voted for. That's $400 million for the city. It'll again be used for everything from affordable housing to obviously the dealing with sea level rise and resiliency issues. Let's start with this, though. You weren't for it at the beginning, were you?
No, I wasn't. And the reason why is because I just didn't like the way it was done. We have a responsibility as commissioners to put things responsibly before the voters. And I say responsibly because I didn't think there was enough community input. I didn't think that we got the list of projects, quote unquote, maybe like a week before the commission meeting. And we're talking about $400 million, or at the time it was actually only $300 million worth of spending. It got increased by $100 million on the dais. And so there was a variety of things that happened at that moment that made me question whether this was being put responsibly before the voters. As a citizen, I voted for it because I felt that the objectives of the bond were good objectives. And I also obviously have confidence in my ability as a leader to usher in those funds responsibly.
And yeah, now that you have that money, the funds are coming in. How do you envision making sure that they are spent correctly?
Well, I think the first thing we got to do is bring citizens to the table. We did that with the Homeland Defense bond money, and we should do that again with the Miami Forever bond money. We need to get our citizens' input. The second thing, particularly with reference to resiliency and sea level rise, we need to get some experts at the table to make sure that we are treating this issue in the right way. I think other cities have just sort of thrown money at the problem and have almost taken a position that water is an enemy rather than water as an asset. And so, I think if we start thinking about the problem a little differently and designing around the problem a little differently, I think we'll have much more success and it'll make us much more resilient going forward.
800-743-9576. If you have a question for Mayor Francis Suarez of Miami, any question about any of the issues that the city is facing moving forward. You talk about the resiliency, obviously, the issues of sea level rise and flooding, water mitigation are problems that a lot of South Florida is dealing with now. And it's not just during storms or high tides or anything like that. Real quickly, how do you judge, you grade what the city has done up to this point, what South Florida has done up to this point? Are we doing enough?
I don't think we are. I think, as you said, it's not just sea level rise. It's a variety of different climatic events. You're talking about king tide. You're talking about rainfall. You're talking about storm surge during hurricanes. I mean, we had during Irma about 4.5 blocks of surge, about a 4-foot storm surge that came in about 4.5 blocks. And I think, after Hurricane Andrew, we gave sort of the world the gift of wind resiliency. I mean, we have some of the most wind resilient buildings in the world. And I think our next challenge is to make our city as water resilient as we can be. Certainly resiliency encompasses a variety of other things as well, economic resiliency, infrastructure resiliency from the perspective of our electrical grid and energy independence. But the challenge definitely is changing the way we think and the way we plan and the way we zone for these things so that we are the most resilient city in the world.
You want to make Miami a model for the world in this, because we are really almost at the center of this issue. I mean, so real quickly, what do you think has to be the next step for you, at least in the next few years, to help make Miami that model?
Well, we were recognized by the Rockefeller Foundation in a co-application with Miami-Dade and with Miami Beach as one of the 100 resilient cities. And well, that day, I remember we were all kind of patting ourselves in the back, and one of my colleagues in the commission said, We can't just be one of the most resilient cities. We have to be the most resilient city. And so I think, the $200 million of resources is definitely a good start. We have to, again, like I said before, think of the problem a little differently. Instead of pumping water into the bay, instead of looking at water as something that we need to raise our streets and then push the water down into our residential and commercial community, I think we need to start looking at other cities around the world, like Copenhagen, that use reuse water and that and make it part of the urban landscape so that it could, you build natural reservoirs that can take water in and drain it out in the appropriate moments.
I wanted to touch on a couple of other big current issues that have been going on. Obviously, the last couple of months we saw with Hurricane Irma, but also Hurricane Maria. With Maria, we're starting to feel the effects here because we are starting to see a lot of people from Puerto Rico coming to the mainland. We spoke to a couple of students at FIU this week. We're seeing people come here, whether it's to finish school, to continue school, or to start their lives over. What have you seen? And look, Miami is been at the center of having a lot of these migrations. But are we ready for this? Are we handling this all right?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been a strain yet on our resources as a city. I'm sure it has put some strains on the school system and a variety of other governmental agencies. We haven't seen it quite yet. But certainly, we're a city that is in good shape financially. We have $164 million in reserves. When I got here, the sky was falling. It was just after the real estate bubble had burst, and we had only $13 million in reserves. So we've done a good job of putting ourselves in a position to deal with any kind of shock to the system. But look, we are, as I said, we're a city that has, and you accurately said it too, we're a city that has historically been a beacon for other cultures and other nationalities when something goes wrong in their own country. And I think that's part of what makes Miami great, actually. And I think that's part of what makes us such a special place.
Something you said to me right before the program, and I joked with you the fact that I'm older than you by a few years,
just a little bit,
but we're of the same generation.
Yeah,
we're Gen Xers, and you had said there's something interesting and exciting about this generation now that it is moving into positions of power. But what is that excitement?
So first of all, it appears, and we've done some of the research on it, but it appears that I may be the first mayor of Miami actually born in Miami.
From Miami.
And so I think there's an excitement that comes with that. I think a lot of people who have experiences similar to mine, where their parents came from Cuba, We were born here in the United States. We're Americans. We were born in Miami, many of us. And so it is interesting. But I think what's interesting also is that the excitement that I see when you have a generational kind of turning of the page is not just in our generation. I see it from millennials. I see it from people my father's and my mother's age demographic. And I see it in people in the older age demographic, their parents. And so I see it as an across the board excitement about and a hope for the future of our city and our community.
Mayor Francis Suarez, the new mayor of Miami. You know what? Invitation always. The studio's open for you,
my
friend.
Thank you so much, Louis.
All right. Again, if you have any questions for him, you know what? We'll try to find those answers for you. You can always tweet us at WLRN Sundial. All right. Coming up next, we're going to talk with a reporter from the Miami Herald, leaving the Herald, going to the New York Times, Patty Mazzei. The story's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, over the last 10 years, Patricia Mazzei has covered and uncovered stories about politicians in Miami and throughout Florida. She's reported from Puerto Rico during Hurricane Maria and the Keys during Irma. She was also in South Carolina following Jeb Bush during his campaign for president when Dylann Roof murdered 9 people in a church in Charleston. She's leaving the Miami Herald after a decade, but she's not leaving Miami. She's about to become the Miami bureau chief for the New York Times. I spoke to her earlier about her career and some of the most interesting moments of the last 10 years. Patty, first of all, congratulations on your move to the New York Times. I mean, is this the dream job?
Thank you. Covering Florida for a national publication is pretty much as good as it gets, yes.
What's your position? What's your title going to be?
I'm going to be the Miami Bureau Chief. So that's the territory that encompasses Florida and Puerto Rico. And so I get to do a little bit of roaming, and then I'll be on the national desk when they cover national stories. You know, they pull different people for different stories around the country.
I mean, you're going to be covering a lot of the same stuff, but how does it change when you're doing it for a local readership compared to, obviously, a national readership?
Well, not everything that rises to the level of a story for a local paper, which is most things that happen in the community, will be of interest to national readers. I think the idea is to break news and also give people a flavor of what Florida is like, places they might not know, issues in local government that might be similar to issues that are happening in other communities around the country, environmental issues that affect Florida that, you know, we are at the forefront of here as ground zero of climate change, as scientists call it. Things like that. I think we're going to kind of tell the story of Florida for people, not just elsewhere in the country, but elsewhere in the world.
All right. So a number of your former colleagues have moved to bigger papers in recent years. Frances Robles, also at the Times. Beth Reinhardt to the Washington Post, where she was part of the team that broke the story about Alabama Senate candidate Judge Roy Moore allegedly dating teenagers. Is there more moving around than there used to be among reporters, do you think?
I don't. I think the Miami Herald has always been a great place for reporters to learn the craft of journalism. And you could spend your career there because this is a great news town. Or you could also move around. I mean, there's sort of pipelines in newspapers where you go from local reporting to national reporting. And also sometimes from national reporting to local reporting again. I think, some of the big name moves are inevitable because this is a state with a lot of politics, with a lot of immigration, with a lot of things of national interest that if you're running another publication, you might want to kind of diversify your journalist base by drawing from places like Miami and other places that are just interesting.
It's Florida. Come on.
Doesn't get any better.
The Times has done some remarkable reporting lately. Is this a new golden age for newspapers?
Gosh, I don't know. I think it's always a good time to be a newspaper reporter. I mean, it's fun and you get paid to be curious. Because national papers have such bigger platforms now, the upside of the internet, which has disrupted the newspaper business model so much, especially at the local level, the upside is that readers have access to more news than ever. And that has helped national publications just grow the number of people who will read them. And local papers, too, just by definition, local means what you write about might not have international appeal in every single story. So, that compounded with an administration that right now, likes to paint the media as the enemy, which is, what politicians have done for time immemorial.
You're a graduate of the University of Miami.
Go Canes.
All right. There you go. You got to get
that in. Turnover chain. Sorry.
It's a good time to get that in. Did you know you wanted to be a reporter?
No, I didn't. No, I wish I could say that I had some great story from age five running around pretending to be a reporter. But no, I found it out in college. I had to find a job on campus. And the Miami Hurricane newspaper, at least while I was there, paid its reporters. And I thought, well, this might be fun. And I started working on the campus paper, and it was a lot more fun than anything else I was doing.
What kind of stuff were you doing?
Well, I was studying economics and political science, which I really liked, but I didn't know what I was going to do with that exactly. And then I learned those are the sort of fields where it really helps to have a PhD. And I wasn't sure I wanted to get a PhD. And then I just spent more and more time in the newspaper, eventually started freelancing for the Herald. And I was somebody who had never skipped class, but I certainly skipped it to go cover a story. And so I picked up a minor in journalism and decided that that's what I was going to do.
And then right out of school, you were at the Herald, right?
Yes, I started working in Neighbors, which is the hyper-local section covering, Key Biscayne, Palmetto Bay, Cutler Bay, Pinecrest briefly, Homestead, and then moved up to cover the Broward School District.
But going back to college, at that point, did you ever think, hey, I want to cover politics? I mean, was that a desire for you? Or
I've always liked politics just kind of naturally. I've followed it closely even without having that be my job. And so covering local government was the way to get started in journalism for me. And there's lots of politics in local government too. And I never wanted to leave that sort of field. Even when I went to cover education is government. I mean, it's so I think covering government and covering politics are two sides of the same coin, really.
You've also had the chance to cover natural disasters. You were in Puerto Rico after Maria.
Yeah,
during Maria, that's right. And then you've covered posts and, of course, Irma during and after. Covering back-to-back disasters especially, what's that like as a reporter? How did you handle that?
I had spent 10 years at the Miami Herald and not had to cover a single hurricane.
Because we had a great streak there.
So it was one of those things that I feel like we prepared for. And when it finally happened, and then we had back-to-back storms, here and in Puerto Rico, it felt like one of those important things that we do. Let me tell you, when you go cover a hurricane that is Category 5 and, later goes down to Category 4, people really appreciate what you do. And they don't have information even on the ground. We were often the first people who were going into some of the towns in Puerto Rico, and we were the first outsiders they had seen since the storm. They thought we were FEMA. They thought we were the government. Volunteers, anything. So you're not only gathering information to share to the rest of the world, you're also kind of bringing information to people to tell them, how is San Juan doing? So it really is one of the most important things that we do. And, the Maria story hasn't ended. And thank goodness that there are still reporters and organizations behind them that have invested time and resources, including the Miami Herald, in really trying to not forget about that story, because everyone wants to talk about the day the storm goes through, but they don't want to talk about the stuff that happens after.
All right, let's talk politics on the largest scale, the presidential election last year, and you had the chance to, you were all over the place. Let's say you've been on WLRN doing a lot of coverage also for us. You were following the Jeb Bush campaign at one point. I wanted to know just overall that last presidential cycle, the campaign, and what it was like for you, and compare that to any other political campaigns that you've had followed.
Well, it was the first time that I was the lead reporter on the campaign, so I don't have a similar experience to compare it to. I think while we were in it, we knew it was a wild campaign, and the reporters who had covered past campaigns thought, this is a historic race because of X, this is a historic race because of Y. And in truth, the presidential election for the United States is always going to be historic in some way or the other. It's just that powerful a position. I think being part of it, you knew that history was unfolding, whatever that history was going to be. It could be the first person elected to office, as it was, who had never held prior office, as president, or it could be the first female president. So either way, it was going to be historic. And I think you knew it while you were covering it, which doesn't always happen. Sometimes you look back and you're like, oh, that was a great story. Like, no, we knew it was a great story.
Well, can you give me one example? Something that jumped out at you during the campaigns?
Well, the first time I covered then-candidate Donald Trump was in Vegas, which felt appropriate, and which I know, Louis, that you know a lot about.
Yes.
And it was because I was there to cover Marco Rubio, who was campaigning in Nevada for the Hispanic vote. Marco Rubio spent some of his years as a child in Nevada, so he had family there. It was a very interesting story to go back and meet his, you know, cousin who was a state senator there and a Democrat. You know, it's just a fun story to tell. And there was also going to be a Democratic primary debate in Vegas. So we were kind of killing two birds with one stone. And I got in early enough that I was like, I'm just going to try to go to this Trump rally. He had only been a candidate for a couple of months. And I got there and the scene was nuts. I mean, there was a huge line. It was like people were trying to get into a nightclub, you know, at 11 in the morning. They ran out of tickets. Tourists were coming up saying, where's Donald Trump? Can I see Donald Trump? There was a Donald Trump impersonator. Someone, you know, jumped on stage to hug him. And I remember writing that story. And my boss is kind of being like, yeah, sure, that's great. You know, it's just one more candidate story to write about. And just thinking like, wow, this is really a movement for a lot of the supporters, and seeing it firsthand so early on, I think, because really helped inform the rest of my coverage.
This was very early on when nobody took him.
This must have been September of 2015. Yeah, so he was already rising in the polls, but he was still considered kind of the colorful candidate. Let's see how long he lasts. I think there had maybe been one debate at that point, or not even one debate yet. So
that's Patricia Mazzei, political reporter for the Miami Herald. I spoke to her earlier about her career at the Miami Herald, which now spans 10 years, because she's leaving that newspaper. Now, she's not leaving Miami. She's going to be covering all the politics and news and all of the oddities about life in South Florida for the New York Times. We'll continue this conversation on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We continue our conversation with Patricia Mazzei, political reporter for the Miami Herald. She's leaving that newspaper and going to move on to the New York Times, but she's not leaving Miami. She's going to be reporting on South Florida for the Times. We continue our conversation about some of the more interesting stories and experiences that she's had, though, over the last 10 years with the Miami Herald. I wanted to ask you about, there was one moment during the campaign you were following Jeb Bush. I don't know if this was as he was announcing or a little after, but it was the shooting in South Carolina, in Charleston.
Yeah, he had just announced earlier that week, and he was going on a trip to hit all the early states. And he could do that because he was flying private, on a private plane. You couldn't physically go from Miami to New Hampshire to Iowa to South Carolina on commercial and hit all the Jeb Bush campaign stops. So we decided to kind of divide things up, and I got South Carolina. I landed in Charleston the night before his morning event and had dinner with another reporter right there in downtown Charleston near the hotel. And when we got back, our hotel was surrounded by yellow police tape. And there wasn't like a big national reporter scene there. It was just like a couple of local reporters and the cops. And it was eerily silent. And we thought, you know, you had that moment where you're like, do we ask what happened? Do we go into the hotel? And we thought, well, let's just find out. Because it looked like there had been a car accident or something and they were clearing up. And then they said, well, we think someone was shot at the church. The church was a block away. We could see it from where we were standing. And we said, okay, let's hang out here for a little while and find out if this is true. And then we heard from someone, we think it was eight people. And I turned to this other reporter who was there, not local, a D.C. reporter. And I said, I don't think we're going to be covering Jeb Bush tomorrow. And it just turned into an all-night, you know, all the political reporters who were in town to cover Jeb Bush and who had been there that day to cover Hillary Clinton, because she had been there too. Suddenly we all turned into police reporters for the night.
What's it like for you? I mean, it's covering politics, covering natural disasters, and then you cover a tragedy like that. How is that different for you compared to maybe a natural disaster?
Well, I think compared to politics, it's a reminder of, we spend a lot of time writing about the horse race. People get upset. You know, this person's up in the polls. This person is down. When you write about nine people being shot dead at a church, it puts a perspective on everything else that you cover and everything you do in life. I mean, it's just one of those very, I'm never going to forget that night in Charleston. I mean, the feeling of someone is out there on the run who did this, who committed this heinous act. How do you kill people, much less in a church? I mean, it's just unfathomable. And I think as a human being, you have to acknowledge that that's, you're not going to think that that's okay in any way. You're not going to write it from some sort of dispassionate, you feel for the people who are there, especially when you're kind of parachuting in for something else and you end up covering it and you're in their community as they're grappling with what this means. We went to a service the day after, right after they had caught Dylann Roof in North Carolina. They had a service with the governor and all the people from Charleston. And we were upstairs in the press area, but the press area was this tiny corner surrounded by people who were, you know, members of the congregation who were there. And they started singing We Shall Overcome, and they grabbed the hands of the reporter who was next to me. And I saw him freeze because we're not participants of the news that we cover. He couldn't let go of the woman's hand. I mean, they're in prayer. They're trying to understand what just happened. They're singing We Shall Overcome. He didn't sing along and sway, but he held her hand. He was a human. And if she had held my hand, I would have held it too. So you don't lose your humanity just because you're covering the news. And I think that's especially true in natural disasters or in horrible situations like this one.
You know, we could spend quite a bit of time talking about your 10-year career. It's 10 years now, right, at the Herald?
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
A decade. There you go. You think about all the things you've covered in that time. We talked about the hurricanes, but you also had, you know, President Obama reaching out to Cuba, Castro's death. Is a lot of big stories, especially recently, but is there any one thing that jumps out at you that is like the big story? Or is there even such a thing for you?
Wow. No, I don't think so. I mean, we reporters always say that we're only as good as our next story. So we're always looking at the next thing. And I feel like having been at the Herald and being lucky enough to cover everything I've been able to cover, including hurricanes finally, even though we all wish we hadn't had them, but being at a place that really emphasizes team coverage of those sort of natural disasters, to cover Fidel Castro's death in Miami, which is one of those things the Miami Herald prepared for a long time, as the whole city did.
Every news organization, right, had a plan.
Correct, the Castro plan. To experience that and see the city grow and change, that is really invaluable. And so I'm thrilled to still be able to be here to keep telling that story, even if it's to a different set of readers, because I think Miami is just a great place for news.
Now, at the beginning of this conversation, you said that this is a great time to be a journalist. It's a great time for news. But look, we've seen it. Newspapers have shrunk. You've seen it happen in your newsroom. I mean, you're optimistic. But why? Why should we be optimistic about the future of our business?
Well, the local newspaper business model is a challenge. And I don't think anybody would tell you it's not, because how do you get the same level of advertising when nobody wants to advertise in print at the rate that they used to, when digital advertising nobody has really quite figured out yet how to make the same amount of money from, and when, if you're counting clicks, if you're a local paper, again, by definition, that's just not going to attract the same audience as a national or international publication. It, also, in terms of subscribers, that's true as well. So I think the business model is ripe for smart people to come in and try to figure out new ways to help support it. Why I'm optimistic long-term about the news is because I think people are always going to need news. And I hope that also means local news. Because as you and I know, radio and TV locally depend a lot on print. They would never say it, but they sit around in the morning meetings in local TV stations.
I'll go ahead and say it.
And read the newspaper and decide what they're going to follow up on that day. Not on every story, but certainly a lot of things that it's just print newspapers. And I say print and I mean online also, right? I don't just mean like actually physical print, but there is something about being able to just go out with your notebook and your pen or your recorder, your iPhone or whatever, and your computer. You can be faster in telling a story than if you need a camera or a microphone. That's just reality. And we can tell more stories and break more stories that then other news outlets can follow. If you kill off the feed for the local TV and radio, the whole ecosystem suffers, right? Because that's like killing the start of the food chain. What happens to the rest of the food chain? National media depend on local media as well to find out what's going on and then decide what they're going to care about to elevate the national level. So if readers care about their local institutions, and democracy kind of depends on the fact that they care. I think we are going to have to do a better job at explaining to them why this matters and why they should invest in it. And then we're going to have to give them a product that is worth investing in. And so the challenge is on both the reader's end and our end. And we're all still kind of struggling to find that happy medium of stuff that people want to read. And that's also important, right? Do you just feed people their vegetables or just dessert? And there's got to be some sort of complete meal that we can put together and that people will want to pay for, because I think people will value good news, and we just have to find better ways to fund it.
That was Patricia Mazet. She's political reporter for the Miami Herald. Again, she is leaving the Miami Herald by the end of this month, but she will not be leaving Miami because her new title is Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And of course, she'll be back on Sundial. I congratulate her and wish her the best as she moves forward. Remember, you can always download a podcast of this program. Find us on iTunes, WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. I really do appreciate it.